He pulls me back, that earnest expression returning again. Listen, how long does it take to become a Shenongshi? 10 years? How many years could you have been training? 2? 3? Not even. Here and there, when Mother forced me to sit down during our shared lessons. But I don't give him the satisfaction of knowing that. We trust the Emperor to provide. We believe the Court of Officials will protect us. What are you talking about? I choke out. I'm saying it's not your fault, he says. The Emperor, the ruler of Daxi, surrounded by all his guards, could not prevent his own death at the hands of someone who wished him ill. You could not have known about the poison. Even your mother, a trained Shenongshi, did not detect it before she drank it. But, I say, uncertain, I should have read the signs. Someone is killing the people of Daxi with the intent to spread unrest, he continues insistently. If you want to blame someone, then blame those who distributed the poison. Blame the officials, blame the ministries, but don't blame yourself. I regard this boy with his assurances, shattering my excuses with the confidence with which he uttered those words. Words that border on treason. And he also revealed something else. He knows the Emperor died from something other than illness. But did the banished prince arrange for his death? Or is someone else responsible? I know the princess wants me to ask the delicate questions, to coax the truth out of him. But I've never been that sort of person, able to hide behind smiles and flirtations. Are you here to put your father on the throne? I ask him. Dangerous questions and dangerous games. Kang blinks, surprised. Not even my father's loyal officials would dare to ask me that. I don't have any loyalties within the court. I shrug, keeping my voice light, even though inside my heart hammers, desperate for an answer to bring back to the princess, mindful of her threat against my family. He regards me for a moment, then gives me a wry smile. No, you're not like them. With a set to his jaw, he continues. There's a darkness descending on the empire. The poison, yes, but also floods and earthquakes. My father believes a new dawn is coming for the dragon throne. But I still remember the girl I grew up with in the palace. Our grandmother would not have raised a fool, and I wanted to see for myself if there is still a chance for peace with Jin. The sound of the bell reverberates through the cavern, signifying the change of day. I realize I have to return to the palace for the evening meal, or I will be missed. We should go, he says, but he looks out at the water, shadows under his eyes. I do the only thing I can think of. I lean over and cup his face, kissing him with gratitude. For holding me while I cried. For saving me from drowning. And for chasing those shadows of guilt away. The bell rings above our heads again, and when we finally separate, he looks dazed, but he is smiling. We return to the palace, the taste of him still lingering on my lips. Yet his answers conjure more questions that worm their way through my mind. Just like the palace itself, tunnels upon tunnels, leading nowhere and no exit in sight. I worry Lian may be waiting in our residence, wondering where I am. But there are only the 2 maidservants. They make no mention of my damp clothes as they assist me with drawing a bath. While I'm drying my hair, Lian strolls in with grass in her braid and her glowing skin a shade darker, grinning from ear to ear. The sun was bright today, perfect for riding, she declares through the wooden privacy screen while she changes, tossing her dirty clothes over the side. She seems to be in an excellent mood. Where were you? She asks. I hear a splash of her entering the tub. I tried to find you after the proclamation, but you were nowhere to be found. I hid in the library, I say, telling her the first place I can think of. We all have our distractions, I suppose, she responds. Do you think the competition will be postponed? I ask. I would venture a guess and say the princess is meeting with her closest advisors tonight. What do you think will happen now that the emperor is... I cannot even make myself say it. The words sound too much like sacrilege. The court of officials love their ceremony, Lan says, unperturbed. The astronomers will be consulted, then an auspicious time will be chosen to prepare for the rise of the new empress. I am certain they will continue with the appointment of a court Shenongshu, as well as whatever other titles they can bestow. How many of these officials and nobles will be forces moving against the princess, doubting her capability to rule? That is all the other competitors discuss at the evening meal, speculating about how long the princess will wait before the ascension ceremony. How messengers have been dispatched to all corners of the empire to inform the regional officials of the news. Even though the current political situation is dire, it means there's less attention on me after my confrontation with Shao last night. When we rise to retire for the evening, Ling Wenyi, the monk from Yeliu, and his companion, Hu Chengzhi, give me nods of acknowledgement, and I give them one in turn. It seems that I may have misinterpreted his words. Perhaps he was defending me, not taking part in Shao's ridicule. Small steps forward. That, at least, I am capable of. When we return to our residence, my eye catches a glint of gold on the lion statue in front of the building. A complex embroidered knot with a jade pendant in the center. I have been summoned. I already knew I was being watched, but the prickling feeling of discomfort still follows. I wish I could have all the rumored abilities of the Shenongshu, able to see through walls or reach into dreams, instead of blundering about, almost dying in the process. A long, thin box sits on the table, my name written on it in an unfamiliar scrawl. I tuck it into my sleeve before Lian notices, afraid it relates to the princess and her impossible task. Later, I lie in bed, with only my thoughts for company, waiting until Lian's breathing slows to a familiar rhythm. I realize I have become accustomed to the sounds of the palace, the tap-tap of the tree branches hitting the rafters, the distant murmur of voices. I am now used to the silk covers that slide against my calluses without catching, being able to eat until I've had my fill without my stomach feeling uncomfortably full from the richness of the dishes. Just like Steward Yang said, it is too easy to live this pampered life, this fantasy. I pull out the mysterious box, wanting to see what the princess has left for me. It is the length of my arm, made of nondescript wood. I slide open the top panel and find a small dagger waiting for me inside. I pick it up and feel its weight, noting the rippling design that appears like waves carved into the decorated sheath. I pull the dagger out, its sharp edge catching the light. At the base of the hilt, an inset black pearl glows with its own luster. A note lies at the bottom of the box. For you, Kang. He had noticed the way I admired the Chamber of the Gods at Lingya. He had spoken about the artistry of his people and wanted to share a piece of it with me. My face warms at the thought. Even if I have no idea how to wield a weapon, I still tuck it into my tunic, enjoying its comforting weight. I slide my legs out of the bed and carefully make my way to the receiving room. From the cabinet, I pull out the tray I hid earlier while Lian prepared for bed. I need the steadying effect of the tea tonight. I wait for the water to bubble, then scald the utensils and the pots. When the steam dissipates above the opening, I place the strands of tea leaves into the pot. I believe in you. Shu sent me off with that assurance, and I've lost myself to my own self-pity and guilt. The strands of lion green seep into the water, turning it the lightest tinge of its namesake color. I place a few pieces of goji berry upon the surface, vaguely remembering that Lian mentioned its properties for cultivating alertness. The red berries plump up and release their essence into the water. I allow myself a few more, needing the additional strength tonight, my first attempt at using something unfamiliar. This is the only thing I will truly miss after leaving the palace. The wide selection of teas, easily accessible, even with my lowly status. I drank it without waiting for it to cool, letting it burn a path down my throat. The magic unfurls within me immediately, called forth as easily as a petal opening to the sun. The faint scent of camellia drifts by, and I know I am ready to face the princess. Chapter 26. Huddled under the hood of my cloak, I keep to the walls, trying to stay with the shadows. The criers follow a schedule, tracking the course of time, and any deviation is strictly punished. The palace guards are less predictable, but prone to fall into routine as well. I have always tracked the natural pattern of living things, having grown up depending on these signs for our food. Birds flying across the sky to signal an early winter, or marks of disturbance in the forest, hinting at the arrival of spring. What are the guards if not another pattern to notice? I slip between buildings, counting steps under my breath as I cross the path to the pond and past the kitchens. I pretend I know this as well as my family's small patch of earth. The press of the mountains above us, their stone peaks unyielding and comforting against the sky, not so different from the looming rooftops of the Hall of Eternal Light. The dense tangle of the wildberry bushes, hiding the presence of small darting birds. I crouch and walk through the rows of purple leaf shrubs covered with tiny pink blossoms. I am through the central garden when I notice the bobbing light of the lanterns in the distance. I press myself against the wall and watch them make their way past the library. The tea sloshes about in my stomach, leaving a bitter aftertaste on my tongue. I let it steep for too long. My skin prickles with a strange sensation. My head swivels too fast, catching the beating of wings in the light, and I am suddenly the hawk swooping overhead in the dark. I am the spider making its way up the brick next to me, spinning its web. The noises of all living things around me swarm inside my head, demanding my attention. The ring of the gong sends me to my knees, crushing the plant below me, releasing a pungent scent. I press my hand tightly to my mouth so that I do not cry out. "The third hour," the criers call out. "The third hour." The hour of the ghost. I will be late. I make my way to my feet, head still spinning. The stars seem to hum mockingly above my head, whispering my name. I stumble down the empty path to the library, away from the guards. My hands I keep on the contours of the wall, its roughness tethering me to the physical world even as I feel like I'm about to burst from my body. I don't notice the slight slope in the ground until I twist my ankle, the sharp pain wrenching me back inside my body, clearing my head slightly. I put in too much goji berry, another mistake. There are some additives so strong they pull you outside your body entirely, until you're cast into the wind and too far away to return. Your physical body will wither away without your spirit to inhabit it. I catch movement out of the corner of my eye, and I throw myself behind a statue. I watch as the figure slides against the wall, blending in with the shadows, using the shrubbery to their advantage. If it weren't for my drink, I'm not sure I would have noticed them. The outline of the body ripples, lit up from within. As they slip through a gap in the trees, the moonlight catches the face and I see it. The flatness of the features, the mask that has haunted my dreams. The shadow. I should sound the alarm, but when I look around, the rest of the garden is still. The guards will not be passing through this place for a time. The shadow touches the wall and the hidden door slides open. The light from the lanterns catches the glint of a blade pressed against their side. Stepping into the tunnels means they will have direct access to the princess's inner garden. If I scream, perhaps the guards will be able to find me before they silence me forever. But that is only if they are able to hear me at all. Father's voice rises unbidden in my mind. We always have a choice. A choice to stand up and do what is right. Even when I did not understand it in my childish ignorance, he still spoke up for the villagers, often at great cost himself. The panel is on the verge of closing. I balance on a precipice, the cliff of indecision. Forced to choose, stay or go, jump or cower. I slip through the gap and pull the lever, shutting myself in with Dashi's monster. The shadow moves ahead through the tunnel and I keep my eyes on their back. The magic courses through my veins. I feel in and out of myself. The voice at the back of my head screams at me. Rip the mask off! Demand the name of those responsible for the poison. Whether they are the creator or merely the distributor, if they know of the blood on their hands. They pull on the iron ring on the wall and the door slides open. They step through, intent on their deadly purpose. Stop! I yell. The figure up ahead falters but doesn't stop. The air ripples, the world folding in on itself. And suddenly I've cleared the space between us in a single breath. I run into them full tilt, and with a grunt, they fall, rolling, not expecting me to be so close. It has to be something in the goji berries. The magic makes everything too bright, and my mind is one step behind, watching dimly as if from a distance, while my body moves. I land with my knee against their chest, but they are already trying to roll away. My attention is drawn to the patch of darkness under their left rib, the way they clutch at that side. I push my weight into that spot just to hear a scream, a wild, ferocious sound of pain and anger. Their other hand fumbles for the sword, but the dagger is unsheathed in my hand in an instant, pressed against their throat in another. When the metal slices the skin, they still, eyes looking up at me, breathing muffled by the mask. Tell me, I demand. Are you the one who poisoned the tea bricks? I wish I had scalding silver needle to pour down their throat, to rip the truth out of them. Another person is upon me in an instant, grabbing me from behind and pulling me away. I struggle, swinging the dagger wildly, but an iron grip grasps my wrist, striking a pressure point. The blade falls to the ground, useless. I suck in a breath to scream, but I'm thrown to the ground easily like a sack of rice. I want to roar at my weakness, but scrabble backward in the dirt instead, turning to face whoever pulled me off the shadow. And the scream dies in my throat. Princess Jin crouches beside the body of the would-be assassin. I don't understand. The sound of drums thunders in the distance. Someone has sounded the alarm. The princess gestures at me wildly. I approach. Help me get her into my chambers, she demands.
But they came here to kill you,
I sputter. No, you fool. She reaches down and rips the mask off the shadow's face. It's Ruyi, eyes closed, mouth contorted into a grimace. A line of red seeps at her throat where I've cut her. Grab her legs, unless you want the guards to find you. I force myself to bend down and help the princess lift Ruyi, still reeling from the revelation of Ruyi's identity. The princess is able to lift Ruyi's body easily with my assistance. She struck the pressure point without hesitation, knowing how to weaken my grasp. I commit this knowledge to memory. She is no cowering flower. Once we reach the princess's quarters, we place Ruyi on the bed, then the princess directs me back to the garden to clear the rest of the evidence. I secure the dagger into my sash and then pick up the shadow's sword. With my other hand, I pick up the mask that landed on the stones. The wood, smooth against my fingers, is still warm from Ruyi's face. Returning to the inner chambers, I note the elaborate screens and beautiful watercolor portraits hanging in the residence. The princess lives in the middle of many treasures. A princess foretold to be both the light and the ruin of an empire. She looks to be a portrait herself, cast in the golden light of the multiple braziers lit around the room. Her face is scrunched with worry as she paces. Ruyi's body convulses and she rolls to her side, where she vomits a torrent of dark fluid. Princess Jin is there immediately without hesitation, pressing a cloth to her bodyguard's forehead. "What did you do to her?" she snarls at me.
"No,"
Ruyi protests weakly.
"Not her."
Then comes a sound of many feet striking the wood floors, followed by shouts of, "Highness! Your Highness!" The princess looks past the doorway, eyes wild. She points to the screen at the side of the room and a duck behind it, still holding the sword and the mask. Scented robes and luxurious fabrics surround me. This is her dressing area. I pull myself farther into the silks, hiding myself as I listen to the raised voices beyond. Through the screen, all I can see are silhouettes, but I know these are armed men. "Do you deem it appropriate to barge into my bedchamber at this hour?" The princess speaks in a restrained tone, showing no indication of the emotion she exhibited not even a moment before.
"My apologies, Highness."
The guards nervously shuffle their feet.
"We had a breach in the palace walls, and we are concerned for your safety."
"As you can see, there's no one here but myself. You should be out there trying to find the intruder."
"Yes, princess."
One of the soldiers raises his weapon in a salute. "We will find the one who dared disrupt your rest and bring you his head."
"See to it that you do,"
she says, her voice cool and composed. The stomp of boots leaves the area and they are gone. I shove the spill of fabrics off me and hurry to the bedside. The princess tugs off the pile of covers she had thrown over Ruyi's body, and I gasp when her face is revealed. Glassy, unblinking eyes. A trickle of black at the corner of her mouth.
"Ruyi!"
the princess whispers through gritted teeth, shaking Ruyi's shoulders, all composure lost.
"Wake up!"
For a moment, I consider leaving her to die. Permit this course of perverse justice if she is truly the one who distributed the poison throughout the empire. But I shake the thought off easily. Saving Shu's life is more important than my desire for vengeance. And if I save Ruyi's life, it will bring me closer to the truth. "Move," I demand of the princess, all courtesy gone. When she does not listen, I pull her away.
"What are you doing?"
She looks at me, lost to panic, hands clawed and teeth bared, ready to tear me apart if I hurt Ruyi. This is beyond loyalty and care of her handmaiden. This is something else. "If you want her to live," I tell her, "get out of my way." Chapter 27. Princess Jin moves aside, biting her lip. "My father is a physician," I say to her, adopting the voice he uses when his patient's family members are in hysterics. "I will do her no harm." No more than what has already been done anyway. But I don't tell her that. She nods then and gestures for me to continue. This for me is a different kind of ritual. Steady hands, calm nerves. Not so different, I realize, from being a Shen Nongshi. I pull the dagger out and, ignoring the gasp of protest next to me, cut away the layers of Ruyi's tunic until the wound is exposed. I hiss when I see the splintered shaft of an arrow buried in her side, the blood bubbling around it. I touch the skin above the wound and she writhes under me, coming in and out of delirium. She is still reactive, and that is a blessing at least, but I know this is not a regular arrowhead. It was coated in a poison designed to inflict pain. I've seen it before. Crow's head. The plant has beautiful purple flowers, but the entire plant, especially the root, is poisonous. If even a small piece of the root is ingested, it can kill someone in an hour. I've seen it used by the mountain bandits, soldiers dying from the poisoned arrows when they do not reach a physician in time. I gingerly palpate her side. The flesh around the wound is hardening, black vessels spreading outward, the poison seeping into her body. "Tell me," Princess asks, her face streaked with tears. "How bad is it?" "She's been poisoned," I say. "I can pull out the arrowhead and stop the bleeding, but I also have to draw out and neutralize the poison before it kills her." "Anything you need," she draws herself up. "Anything you need, and it is yours." Despite the urgent task at hand, a darker part of myself recognizes that this is my chance to get the answers I need. I told Kong I would ask for the head of the shadow. And now I have not only her identity, but her life in my hands. "Why was Ruyi in Su?" I ask. Princess Jin blinks, not understanding. "Tell me why she was in Su," I demand. "Is she the one responsible for the poison? Is she distributing it at your behest?" "How dare you?" she snaps, taking a step in my direction, fists clenched at her sides. "The longer you wait," I remind her, "the deeper the poison will enter her body, and the harder it will be to save her." I gamble on the suspicion that she is willing to trust in an untrained physician's assistant rather than call for the aid of one of the royal physicians. It means she has something to hide. The princess weighs this. Then she sighs as she looks down at Ruyi. "I sent her to look into who is behind the poisonings and whether they had a direct hand in what happened to my father." "Why did you hide his death for so long?" I ask. "Did he disagree with your plot utilizing the tea bricks? Were you planning to cause the unrest yourself and come back with a pretty cure? Win the hearts of the people?" Red blooms across her face. "I would be very careful with your next words. I could have you executed the moment you step out of this room." Ruyi's body thrashes again underneath my palms. She lets out a guttural moan. I hold her down quickly, pulling her eyelids back. I can see only white. "Look at her!" I yell at the princess. "Tell me, why was she in Su?" "Stop! Yes!" The princess climbs onto the bed and kneels at the head of her handmaiden, speaking rapidly. "She was there investigating on my behalf, following the procession that delivered my invitations across the empire, seeing if anyone would interfere. But someone followed her at each turn, sowed seeds of distrust, until it became difficult for her to keep her disguise. But I swear to you," she reaches out and grips my arm, "I've nothing to do with the poisonings. I want Da Xi to be reunited and strong. I will not do it by killing commoners." She could be lying to me still, but her eyes are only for Ruyi, her concern obvious. "A life for a life," I say to her, ready to bargain. "If I heal her now, you will owe me a favor. Do you have the cure-all stone?" Princess Jin blinks at me, then dismisses me with an agitated wave of her hand. "That's just a folktale. It doesn't exist. Do you think I would not demand its use now if it were real?" So Kong told me the truth, but something inside me still crumples at the thought. "Then the use of your royal physicians," I tell her. "For treatment of the poison." She interrupts me with a growl, unable to hide her frustration. "Don't you understand? The poison is what killed my father. The royal physicians were unable to slow down its course. The only way to stop it is to discover the antidote." My heart hammers in my chest. Someone dared to poison the emperor, and now I have a new purpose. I have to find the antidote. "You will grant me access to your storerooms then," I say quickly. "Access to the antidote, when it is discovered." "Yes, done," she says without hesitation. "Now help her, please. Where are your kitchens?" I know from speaking with Steward Yang that there is a smaller kitchen for the inner palace. At this time of night, the ovens are quiet and the stoves dark, but I am still cautious. I draw on both my mother's art and my father's practice as I rummage through the pots and drawers. Slices of licorice root and round, dried pieces of bitter buckwheat, long strands of ginseng, like an old man's beard. I gather everything I need and hurry back to the princess. The room is almost unbearably warm due to the instructions I left behind. The braziers have now been moved closer to the bed. The princess has torn garments into strips for bandaging and stoked the fire until it is hot enough to disinfect the blade. If this was a regular arrowhead, I would leave it, allow it to plug the wound. I explain to the princess so she does not strike me down for cutting into her handmaiden. But because of the poison, I have to pull it out. It will be bloody. She nods. After wiping Kong's blade clean on my tunic, I pass it through the fire a few times to cleanse the metal before preparing myself for the task of extricating the arrow from the wound. Hold her, I command, and once I am sure she has a good grip, I place my hand on the broken shaft. Using the dagger, I make an incision to help loosen the head and slide the arrow out. Blood spurts, splattering the front of my tunic. Ruyi's body arcs and then she crumples again. The princess narrows her eyes, but her hands hold firm as she grits her teeth, bracing herself with one leg off the bed. Even though I know it is due to the pain, I test Ruyi's pulse to be sure. Weak, fluttering, but still there. I have to work fast against her body, which is slowing down. All blood will run to the heart, carrying the poison with it. I'm running out of time. I can draw the poison out, but I don't think she will survive without something to strengthen her body, I tell the princess when I scrutinize the extent of the wound. I need help. What do you mean, help? She asks. I need another shenengshi, or at the very least, a shenengtu, I say to her. She shakes her head. I can't. I can't involve anyone else. It's too dangerous. The poison... She hesitates for a moment before continuing. It leads to someone in the Ministry of Rites, perhaps even the council itself. I could almost shake her, force it out of her, but the terror in her expression is real. The way she clutches Ruyi, smoothing the hair away from her face. I decide to go with the truth. You have to choose. Your plan or her life. She looks down at Ruyi, the conflict clear. But then her expression smooths, as impenetrable as the wooden mask the shadow dons. Who would you suggest? She says. Only the barest quiver of her cheek betrays her true emotions. Lien, the daughter of the Kala ambassador. The princess nods. Only her, no one else. I bring Lien back to the inner palace through the hidden tunnels as directed, making a brief stop at the kitchens along the way for more ingredients. Lien keeps glancing over at me during our trek through the tunnels, muttering to herself. It was easy to convince her of the urgency of the matter, with my disheveled hair and the blood on my tunic. The only thing she says to me when we approach the princess's residence is, "All that time spent at the library, huh?" I promise you, I usher her through the door. I will explain everything after. The princess looks up when we enter and greets Lien with a nod. I require your skills. I gesture toward the figure on the bed. You say your mentor specialized in strength. Do you think you would be able to fortify her body and keep her alive while I draw out the poison? Lien chews on her lip, considering this. Poison? Yes, an arrow dipped in crow's head. Ah, she recognizes the name. I've seen it done, but I haven't tried it myself. Yi Li Cuhai, I mutter to myself. Our task is like trying to measure the sea with a single gourd. Nearly impossible with the limitations of my age, my lack of knowledge. Lien snorts. No wonder you need my help. All we can do is try. At least one of us is optimistic about our chances of success. Lien gets to work on her tonic, using the tray of ingredients we collected at the kitchens. I wouldn't call myself a healer, she says as she pinches this and pulls out slivers of that and places them into a pot. But my teacher knows how to push the physical limits of the human body. Perhaps this will help hold her together. I glance at her ingredients to make sure my choices will not counteract the effects of her tonic. Lian has chosen mugwort to improve circulation, crimson mushroom to strengthen the heart. Usually I would brew this overnight, she says, shaking the herbs. But we don't have time. Definitely not with the dampness of Rui's skin, the black rings around her eyes, and the black veins creeping ever closer to her heart. The herbs steep in the hot water, then Lian pulls the bag out of the pot and squeezes it over a bowl. Cupping the bowl in both hands, she takes a deep breath, then blows across the surface. I can feel the infusion of magic, the spicy scent of cinnamon, even though I know there was none in the mix. Sit her up, Lian says, a subtle shift in her voice. A commanding tone like someone else speaks through her. The surface of the bowl ripples. The princess adjusts her bodyguard's position so Ruyi is sitting between her legs, supported against her. Open her mouth. The light in the room begins to flicker, even though there is no breeze. Princess Jin looks like she is about to protest, but I give her a shake of the head. She nods in resignation and tips Ruyi's head back. The liquid goes in, but Ruyi coughs, and the tonic trickles out the corner of her mouth. Keep it in, Lian directs me as she holds the bowl above Ruyi's head again. The princess pulls Ruyi's mouth open, and with my assistance, we close it once all the tonic enters, forcing her to swallow. The tension in the air eases, and the room once again smells faintly of incense. Lian sinks back to her seat and blinks. It's done, she whispers, sounding once again like herself. I draw in a shaky breath as I approach. I can feel the weight of the princess's and Lian's gazes, expectant, waiting for me to fulfill my part of the bargain. For Shu, I tell myself, and climb onto the bed, readying myself for the task ahead.
Chapter 28. My dilemma is evident before me. I need to expel the poison from Ruyi's body, but she cannot lose more blood in her weakened state. I sift through the tray with my fingers, hesitating over this ingredient and the next, before settling on peelings of the umbrella tree, a common ingredient in any apothecary shop. I wish I had stronger ingredients, such as Hu Huang Lian or the bark of the silk flower tree, but those would be in a physician's storeroom and not as easily accessible. I mash the concoction of bark and leaves between my fingers until it becomes something I can easily manipulate in my hands, a living poultice. Then I pack the paste into her wound, leaving dark smears against her skin. Rolling the remnants into a ball, I place it under my tongue. The taste of it is repulsive, but I force my lips to close. I've seen my mother perform this ritual before, when she worked alongside my father, the two of them practicing their respective arts side by side like an intricate dance. I place my hands on either side of Ruyi's head and close my eyes. Shen Nong is communion, a joining of your soul to theirs. Be vulnerable, be open. I understand now. The magic is not in the ceremony of pouring the tea or the sharing of the cup. It is in the connection, the brief joining of souls. The tea leaves are a channel, the ingredients the signposts. I can see Ruyi lying at the roots of a great tree, surrounded by a swirling darkness. Swallowing my fear, I approach her, the tendrils of smoke parting at my feet. But there is no telltale smell of fire. Where the smoke dissipates, I can see past her skin and muscle. Her body is translucent, lit up by dazzling pathways of red and gold, blood and life essence moving through her. But there, spreading from the wound at her side, is a writhing, pulsating darkness. Its tendrils have already wrapped around her intestines and liver, tracing their way upward toward her beating heart. Leaning forward, I place a hand on her shoulder. She looks up at me with dazed eyes. Who are you? She's afraid, knowing something is not right. I don't know what to do. Above our heads, the tree rustles. Then the head of a crane dips down through the leaves. It is a beautiful bird with snow-white feathers and a head crowned with vivid red. The Lady of the South. Her voice rings in my head. The receiver must be willing. I think of how the princess carefully wiped the sweat from Rui's brow, how she threw herself into harm's way without hesitation to protect her handmaiden from harm. Each touch speaks of shared intimacies. Jin sent me, I tell Rui now. I only want to help. Jin? A bit of clarity returns to her as she turns her face toward me. Then she gives me a slight nod. I don't know if she sees the bird above us, but I look up at the goddess, silently asking her what I must do next. She inclines her head. Reach in and grab it. When a goddess instructs, I know I must listen. Even though every part of me is shrieking in protest at the thought of touching that darkness, I reach in. It feels like my hand is sinking into warm water, like when I touched Kong with the assistance of the golden key. I force myself to contain my revulsion when I can feel a slippery chill glide through my fingers. Rui screams when I try to pull it back, as if I am ripping her heart out of her body. The darkness grows barbs, sinking into her organs like nettles embedding themselves into flesh. Setting my jaw, I grasp the darkness with two hands, struggling to hold onto it with all my strength. It thrashes, attempting to burrow its way deeper, trying to make its way to her heart. But Lian's tonic shimmers like a silver cage, repelling its attempt to take hold. Stop! Rui cries out. You're killing me! The rustling grows louder above our heads, as if the tree is blown by a wild wind I cannot feel. The crane has disappeared. With a sickening pop, the darkness comes free. In my hands, it feels like pulsating, muscular flesh, and it lashes at my arm, drawing red welts. Blood beads like rubies against my skin. Malevolence creeps into my mind, a fluttering of tongues brushing against the edges of my mind. It wants nothing more than to consume. It craves life, for it has no life itself, and I open myself to it. It slithers up my chest. I can sense its hunger and eagerness as it forces itself into my mouth. I choke, tears filling my eyes, hands going to my throat. It tastes of spoiled meat and decay, the rot of betrayal, the resentment of being forgotten. It is going to take what it was promised. Blood and memories, flesh and life. With a gasp, I return to my body, throwing myself off the bed, landing on my hands and knees. I spit the medicinal ball out of my mouth. It splatters on the wood floor with a sickening sizzle, and smoke rises from the pulp. The smoke forms itself into a lithe, twisted form. Grotesque protrusions begin to sprout from the serpentine body, and three heads emerge, features shaping themselves before our eyes like a sculptor forming wet clay. Three heads with human faces, skin a gray pallor, thin lips, pale eyes, and a sound like the grinding of teeth emanating from the gashes of their open mouths. I stare at this hideous apparition. My body frozen in terror. It lifts itself up on its coiled body, and the mouths smile down at me, revealing sharp, dagger-like teeth. With a cry, the princess lands before me, a curved half-sword in her hand. The blade sweeps in a deadly arc, and the heads roll when they land, coming to a stop not far from my feet. The body wavers on itself before toppling onto its side. As quickly as it formed, the monster disappears into smoke, leaving the scent of putrid flesh and a black mark on the floor, like someone held a torch too close to the wood. The sword lands on the floor with a clatter, and the princess crouches in front of me. Her mouth moves, but I hear nothing. The last thing I remember is slipping into blessed darkness, closing over my head like the waters of the sacred spring. A gong sounds,
reminding me there's something I must do, someone I have to meet. It's almost the hour of the thief. Panic grips my chest, making it hard to breathe. I fumble with the blankets, kicking.
Ning? Ning?
Lian slowly comes into focus, her brows drawn together in worry.
You're awake, she sighs. Where?
I look around and I see I'm in our room. I don't remember coming back here. There's a dull thud in my temple and my throat is raw and burning. Lian thrusts a cup into my hands. I drink it eagerly and it washes a soothing path as it goes down. There are no additives, no magic. Only a good cup of tea, brewed to sweetness, as familiar as a mother's embrace.
How did I get back here? I ask.
She's sitting on a stool as she has moved by my bed, looking as serious as I've ever seen her. The princess had one of her guards carry you back, she says. I try to nod, but that sends a sharp twinge of pain skittering across my skull. I wince and press my fingers into my forehead, but it doesn't ease the pain.
It'll take some time to get better, Lian says, then adds hastily, you probably already know that. Being able to do what you accomplished.
She has an odd look in her eyes, like she's not certain of who I am anymore.
I saw the goddess,
I whisper, uncertain of who I am either.
She helped me. The goddess?
She echoes.
A bird. The Lady of the South?
She nods in understanding.
We know her as Bifeng. Goddess of Fire.
After a pause, Lian finally asks me the question I can tell has been circling in her mind.
What happened last night? Why were you in the inner palace?
I'm seized by the same sort of hesitation I felt the day I returned from my encounter with Kung. I'm afraid of judgment, afraid she'll accuse me of cheating. But Lian has always helped me without question. I've seen her kindness with the kitchen staff, the same respect extended to everyone, from the servants to the highest officials. She has offered friendship, and I have lied to her from the beginning. Now, at the very least, she deserves the truth. I begin, hesitant at first, with my mother's death and my sister's poisoning. How I grappled with the shadow, then met Kong in the market. How it led to my encounter with the princess, and finally the events of last night. The only things I do not speak of are the intimate moments between me and Kung. Those I keep for myself.
How did you hide it from everyone?
She sputters when I am done. She's pacing the length of our room, braid swinging, considering everything I've told her.
Secret meetings with the princess? Sneaking around with the emperor's nephew?
I would be happy to leave all this behind if I could only secure the antidote for my sister, I say, determined.
So then, she looks at me, what about after? Will you stay there?
My mother was able to do it, I say, as if there is no twinge inside me when I speak those words, as if I have not spent most of my life looking for escape from that village.
It sounds like your mother made her choices for her family. But what about you? What do you want?
I don't want to talk about my mother. I don't want to talk about my future, imaginary or not. All I know is I need to focus on finding the antidote. If the poison that affected Ruyi is the same as the one that killed my mother, that snake creature, have you seen it before?
Lian shudders. Those faces were an abomination. Nothing like that should exist.
I think the goddess tried to warn me before, I tell her. When I first encountered the poisoned tea, I saw a snake too. The two of them must be connected somehow.
Lian crosses her arms, considering this. Someone tried to kill the closest person to the princess, not to mention the multiple attempts on her own life.
And someone has already killed her father, the most powerful and protected person in the empire. If I value my life, this is knowledge I should keep to myself.
but I need someone with knowledge of the intricacies of the court. Lian would be able to tell me who I can speak with and who I should avoid. My friend does not appear surprised by this, only troubled. You know this for certain? The princess did not deny it. It's just as my father said, she shakes her head. The Prince of Dai will return to reclaim what he believes to be his. After all this time? 10 years is a long time, for an empire to change, for loyalties to shift. I was in the palace when the Prince of Dai attempted to overthrow the emperor. Her voice is soft, but the fear in her eyes betrays her. I was young, but I still remember. How scared I was when Father sent me through the back gate. I watched the palace burn. The court splintered. Many were executed when the rebellion failed. She pauses in her pacing to regard me with a severity that makes her appear older than her years. But many innocents who played no part died too. I don't want you to get hurt. Be careful, Ning. I am reminded of the night I tiptoed out of the house in the dark, when a girl younger than me in age, but wiser in all other things, gave me a similar warning. I would like to think we are friends, I say, my way of apologizing for hiding things from her. We are. She gives me a smile, and the way ahead seems less daunting, if only for a moment. Chapter 29. That evening, we don our competitors' robes, our new outfits devoid of color or ornamentation. Only the royal family can be clothed in mourning white, but the rest of the palace residents show our respect by wearing black. White banners hang from the rafters and before every doorway to remind us of Da Xi's loss. We do not resume the competition in the Hall of Reflection, but instead, as befitting the virtue of wisdom, we meet in the top room of the library pavilion. From here, the latticed windows are cut into the shape of flowers and reveal the lights of the palace grounds and the city beyond. Outside, a warm spring rain drizzles over the rooftops, casting everything in a misty hue. This room appears to be one for meditation and practicing calligraphy, as there is only one scroll hanging from the wall, with three characters written in a flourish. Ren, Zhi, Chu. The eternal question and conflict posed by the philosophers. Is it human nature to be good or evil? How many emperors and empresses have stood here in this very room and looked up, pondering how they will answer that question in order to guide the people of Da Xi? Has Princess Jin ever stood in the very place where I am standing now, thinking about the same question? What is her answer? The birds are again present in their gold cages, their permanent residence not the Hall of Reflection like I initially believed. This time I take note of their feathers, a rich deep purple fading to green tips. Their eyes are dark spots with a bright sheen, the curve of their scarlet beaks ending in a sharp point. We return to the third round of the competition. Elder Guo looks particularly foreboding in black robes, like a fortune teller about to pronounce a dire omen. She is the only judge present at this time, having already passed along her regards from the others this evening. They are preoccupied with the future of the empire for the moment. It is imperative that we continue with our efforts, she continues. We will not allow dissidents to disrupt the course of the competition. For Da Xi is a mighty river, and they are only broken branches to be carried away by the current. Her words are meant to provide reassurance, but I've learned to see through the platitudes of court officials, how their actions sometimes conflict with their grandiose pronouncements. After all, with enough dissidents, one could build a dam that could divert the most powerful of rivers. Behind me are the Piya, the embodiment of the phrase, attack poison with poison. We train the birds from birth. They are continually fed a diet of poisonous creatures until they are both immune to poison and are poisonous themselves. She smiles at our shared confusion and unfamiliarity with such creations.
I thought they were birds of legend,
Guoming says.
They aren't real.
I assure you, Elder Guo says. They are very real. You may recognize them by another name, the poison feather bird. Their bite, their claws, their tears, their excrement, all contain poison. They are also excellent poison detectors, for they will not ingest what they cannot endure. Now for your next task. She gestures at the birds. Only by working closely with your partner will you be able to succeed. One of you will transform a lethal poison so that the piya will willingly ingest it against its nature. The other will counter the poison and save the bird's life. If the piya refuses to ingest the poison, you will fail. If the bird dies, you will fail. Only if your team fulfills both tasks will you be able to move forward.
What sort of poison will need to be transformed?
Wen Yi asks, a question befitting one who has dedicated his life to the academy. Elder Guo's eyes gleam, and she utters with doting affection, almost as one would say the name of a dear child.
Jin Chen.
Gasps of revulsion, my own included, join the sounds of the birds.
She's mad,
Lian comments under her breath, and I agree. The Jin Chen is a gold silkworm, an abomination of nature. Mother said it was folklore, an ancient ritual practiced by those who used to tamper with darker magics. It is a chaotic magic that will eventually devour anyone who delves too deeply into it. The silkworm about to form its cocoon is harvested and sealed into a jar with poisonous creatures gathered under the darkest night of the new moon. The jar is buried, then opened 1 week later. The creatures will have slaughtered one another, and the pupa will turn gold, having subsisted on the blood of the ones that devoured each other beside it. The pupa never emerges from the cocoon, residing there in a suspended state. It is not alive, but neither is it truly dead. Some say the spirit of the silkworm leaves the body entirely, and the spirit can only be satisfied with blood. One drop of the creator's blood binds the Jin Chen spirit to do its bidding, but you run the risk of being devoured if you do not keep it fed. Once I might have laughed at the absurdity of such a horror. But then last night I pulled a snake wearing 3 human faces out of a woman's body. There are darker and stranger forces out in the vast wide world than I could ever comprehend with my limited imagination. Tomorrow you will have access to the storeroom of the royal physicians. We will reconvene in the evening after the summer rites have been performed. I had forgotten that tomorrow is the call to summer, a festival signifying the change between seasons. Tonight you will choose one of these birds and tend to it in your residences. These birds are national treasures, Elder Guo says as we survey the piya, considering the daunting challenge presented before us. If they come to harm, it is not only your position in the competition you should worry about, but what sort of punishment you will receive. Shao and Guoming elbow each other with confident smirks, not worried about the threat. They are the ones who rush to the pedestals first, swiftly ushering away their chosen bird. I look at Lian and she gives me a shrug. I know nothing about the care of animals, but the choice is made for us soon enough. I lift the one remaining bird from its pedestal and it gives me an indignant squawk at being jostled.
What about the Jing Chen?
Shao asks when we all return to our places, birds in hand. I trust none of the other competitors apart from Lian, even though Wen Yi and Cheng Zhi are amicable enough. But of the remaining Shen Neng Tu, I trust Shao the least, after having seen him in the residence of the Marquis.
You will be permitted the use of a single dried pupa tomorrow evening,
Elder Guo says, upon which she will perform the transformation for us to review. We bow as we leave the chamber. I can't help but glance back once more at the question on the calligraphy scroll hanging above our heads. Good or evil? How much do you know about these birds? I ask Lian once we return to our rooms. I set the bird on one of the side tables. It swivels its head in an uncanny way, watching our every move. Not much, she admits, peering at it through the bars of the cage. They are unnatural creations. I cannot imagine how many birds have to die in order to create them. The same for the Jingchen, I shudder. So many had to die, and for what? Lian nods solemnly. It is contrary to the art of Shennong, to what my people call the Chi, for its sole purpose is the taking of a life. It is a weapon, nothing more, as much as Elder Guo likes to pretend it has a higher purpose. I'm surprised the ministry has approved its use. Perhaps it is a way for the princess to see who exhibits comfort with the use of poisons, and in turn will lead her to the one